Welcome to the Horror Hounds podcast, where the lore hounds your guides to small town terrors. I'm John.
I'm Alicia, and this is our coverage of It, Welcome to Derry on HBO Max, Season 1, Episode 1, The Pilot.
If you want to get in contact with us, send an email to horror@thelorehounds.com or head to our Discord server from the link tree in the show notes for a silo discussion of each episode of this series.
And if you like what you've heard and want to support us or get ad-free bonus content, check the same link tree for our Patreon and Supercast subscription options. We'll talk more about upcoming episodes there at the end, right?
We sure will. Now, we've got another co-host with us today, Mark from Nevermind the Music. Hello, Mark.
Hi, John. Hi, Alicia. Happy to be here. Talk some Stephen King, or maybe not Stephen King. Is this an adaptation? I don't know. We'll talk.
Yeah, we'll talk about it. We're going to talk about some background, but, you know, very quickly, you're joining us this episode. I know you're going to join us where you can in this season, right?
Yeah, I want to be a part of it as much as I can. Let's see how the schedule works out and et cetera. Yeah, looking forward to it.
Very cool. And if people haven't heard your podcast, what is it about?
Nevermind the Music. Me, a musician, and Nicole, a psychologist, talk about songs. Check us out. We've actually got Alicia coming up as a guest this week in honor of the World Series, which is just evened up 2-2. We've got the organist from the San Francisco Giants in to talk about what it's like to play in the mass cultural moment of sporting events, which I thought was a pretty cool guest. But next week, we're talking about Blondie, just Nicole and I. And then Alicia's here to talk Hope Punk and even a little Superman the week after that. So people should check us out if you haven't already.
I'm loving it. That's great stuff. So everyone go check out Nevermind the Music. That's also in the link tree in the show notes. You can find all of our affiliates there, but especially Nevermind the Music because Mark's here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the first episode, housekeeping, like I said, Mark will be joining us when he's available, but Alicia and I will be doing weekly coverage every week, no matter if Mark is available or not. And I wanted to do some background of everybody on the It franchise and Stephen King generally. Mark, you're our guest for today. So what's your history with Stephen King and the It franchise?
So it is, I want to say, kind of like the same era as The Wheel of Time for me, which is to say a book I was handed when I was a middle schooler that was very dauntingly big, but I read. So I read it probably when I was a seventh or eighth grader, and that was the first Stephen King book I'd read, and it was very inappropriate for me to read at that age, especially a scene at the near the end of the book, which might come up later this season, but I actually kind of hope does not. But it
never comes up in any of the movies. Well, I think I know what you mean.
It sure doesn't. Yeah. Are we talking about that? Should we just talk about it now? Go ahead, John. Sorry.
I just think that particular scene, I don't think we should even talk about it on air because the entire Stephen King fandom, I think, has pretty much chosen to ignore this scene
and pretend it never happened. Yeah.
And Stephen, right. I think there was a lot of cocaine going on.
Yes.
And things were written that didn't need to be written.
But I do have to say, I mean, I know we'll get into hot takes in a second, but one thing, they're obviously taking these interludes for this show and expanding them. But it does feel very Stephen King in the sense of like, there's a little bit of sexual reproductive terror going on.
So for me, that was just the beginning, though. I probably, like a lot of people my age, my dad was a big my dad's was born named Stephen King. My last name is not actually my dad's birth name. It's his stepfather's name. And my dad was Stephen King. Sorry, Dad, okay. I'm outing you. And he's about he's about the same age as Stephen King, spelled differently though. And yeah, so I was handed a lot of those books. So what have I read? I actually went through the list of Stephen King's books, and I've read 19 Stephen King novels. So I read it twice. I read it probably when I was 12, and then again when I was in my early 20s or something. And I have not read it in like probably almost 20 years or something like that. But I've read Salem's Lot, I've read The Shining, I've read Doctor Sleep, which is the sequel. I've read The Stand, plus the graphic novel of The Stand. I've read all 7 Dark Tower books, plus The Wind Through the Keyhole, which I guess is the 8th book, plus the graphic novels. I've read The Tommyknockers, 11-22-63, The Outsider, Holly, Different Seasons, and Four Past Midnight. Those last two are two of the short story collections. Plus movies. So, like, I haven't read it in a while, but I feel like I can't believe how much Stephen King I've read, actually, over the years. Kind of crazy. So, I'm definitely here for this. Saw the 90s miniseries when I was a little kid. Saw the It movies a few years ago. I'm here for it.
Wow, you are going to be our book expert. I know you said you haven't read it in a while, but let's pretend you did.
Well, the weird thing is, like, because I've read The Dark Tower pretty recently, a lot of this stuff is connected. So I feel like I've been reminded of a lot of...
Right.
There's, you know, Pennywise is a character in It, but, like, the cosmology, the turtle, all that stuff comes up in a lot of the other books, and some of these characters, or, like... You know, Juniper Hill Asylum shows up as a, you know, mention in so many of the books. There's a whole interconnectivity to a lot of this. So I feel like it feels more recently than, you know, the 2000s since I've read this book, so to speak.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's a lot of cosmology. I know that there's a bunch of Pennywise stuff where people are like, what is happening with the Dark Tower? So I'm curious to have you bring that up if things are referenced as we go along. I heard that there was a turtle reference in this episode. I didn't catch it.
There were multiple.
We should probably talk turtle later. Let's talk some.
All right, we'll have turtle talk.
Yeah,
that's right. That's right. Okay, Alicia, your history with this franchise and Stephen King.
I mean, Stephen King overall, I think I first discovered him actually finding like a couple Richard Bachman books on the shelf, which for anyone who doesn't know is a pen name that he would write some books under back in the day. So I think like this first Stephen King book I read was actually a Richard Bachman book called Thinner and like The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon. Definitely got into those, which lean more toward magical realism. And then I think I was too young when the 1990 It came out. I definitely didn't watch that on TV at the time. But when The Stand came out on TV, then I was a teenager and I watched it with my parents, and that made a huge impression on me. I didn't do as Mark did and mark down exactly what Stephen King books I've read. I've read a lot of them. Especially some of the more recent ones. The Dark Tower series is my sister's favorite series. Definitely read like, what is it called? Was it Dreamcatcher? Mm. A Bag of Bones, stuff like that. Yeah. And I just started now. I decided, okay, I'm going to finally read it, or rather I'm doing the audiobook version, so that I was like, I can't, I have too much other stuff to read. I can't interrupt my physical reading. So I got the audiobook version and I am a couple chapters in now.
Have you read The Dark Tower, or it's just your sister has and so you feel like you've read it genetically?
I have read more than half of The Dark Tower. I do still need to finish that series, but I see the overlaps. I definitely see the overlaps. And I just posted on Blue Sky, with the It stuff, and you know, I obviously just rewatched all the It movies before this, and I was thinking that house that Jake goes through in the drawing of 3,
yes,
which is I think the second book. Is that the same as the
house that's on Newbold Street?
And It.
It's a good question.
It seems very similar. There's and the spider stuff and the wallpaper, and there's like a lot of stuff that's screaming at me, same house.
That house is in New York, I think, but right. It might kind of be
metaphysically.
Some of the weirdest connections potentially are actually in the last couple books. So, like, I'll take it easy if I'm trying to mention Dark Tower stuff. But I don't. I'd have to remember. It's been a while since I've read The Drawing of the 3. There's this character that ends up kind of like almost interdimensionally going to this old house, and it does have a lot of vibe similarities to the scene, if people remember, the kids go in this haunted house in the 2017 film, is there a werewolf in there or something? I'm trying to remember what's in there in the film version, but that's the house she's talking about.
But yeah, in the drawing of the three in the Dark Tower book, there's particularly spider stuff going on that always stuck in my head. So, and then I realized, yeah, because the it entity often appears as a spider.
Yeah.
Well, I think we can talk more about the connections as they come along.
Okay. What about you, Jen?
Very cool. And by the way, I'm glad that you, first of all, I'm glad that Mark has a bunch of Stephen King background, and I'm glad that you're reading it right now, because I started it, I read the first few pages, and I went, you know what? I don't have to be the book expert for this. Let's just, I don't need to do this to myself. And I just stopped. I was like, I just, it's okay. I saw the movies. That's where I'm going into this with. I've read The Shining. I think that's the only, oh, and I read The Drawing of the Three a long time ago, but those are the only Stephen King books that I've really read all the way through. I've tried to read it a few times, but it was just so daunting, which is funny because I'll read like the Stormlight Archive and the Wheel of Time, like 1,000-page fantasy books, but for some reason, it is a mental block for me.
Try the audiobook. It's really good.
Yeah, maybe I will. Maybe I will at some point. Probably not this season, but we'll talk about it. We might have more opportunities to cover this show.
So Stephen King books, like part of what you sign up for, they don't cut to the chase. So like you can be, I'd have to really look at my list and think like, what's an example? You know, there could be a supernatural horror novel that's Stephen King, written by Stephen King, that you're like 250 pages in and there's no supernatural horror and you're just like lost in the sauce of these people's lives. And you can either go, this is a waste of time, or you go, this is actually the point. It's like, I'm building this real understanding of the characters, right? So like, I can think of 11-22-63. I don't know if any of you saw the miniseries based on that, but that's basically somebody goes back.
That was excellent. Yeah,
it was. It was pretty well done. But somebody goes back in time to try to prevent the assassination of JFK, right? And there's this whole bit in the middle. This guy fills his time while he's back in the 60s waiting for the assassination to stop. And I'm not spoiling anything major, but he becomes a high school teacher. And there's this whole, like, I want to say 100-page sequence that is him trying to get the football players to sign up for the drama club to do this play they're doing. Like, and you kind of stop and you go, like, what is the point of this? And then you go, wait, but this is the best part of the book, because he's falling in love with this other teacher and he's becoming enmeshed in this and you know that his mission is to do this harrowing, obviously very supernatural thing, which is stop the assassination. But you realize that the emotional core of the book rests on these random character life story interactions. And with it, yes, there's the murder at the beginning and things like that. There's a lot of supernatural horror, but there's also a lot of like 11-year-olds doing stuff, and it can be daunting, and you can be like, oh, what am I here for? But the truth is, you're here for that. And if you're not here for that, the like childhood nostalgia kind of stories, then you're not here for Stephen King, right? So I don't know. I guess I just want to tell people, when they see a 1,000-page book, be ready for a while for it to warm up, right? The Shining, you've read, John, like the ghosts aren't there for a real long time, you know?
Right.
But that's like part of what makes, like, if it was a 200-page ghost story, it wouldn't be Stephen King and it wouldn't be as great as, you know, this story that's really about alcoholism that takes so, so, so long to get where the iconic film scenes are.
Yeah, I just was rewatching, as I said, of course, the recent It movies. And I was thinking that that's exactly what they kind of got wrong in the part two. Like, I like part two. I think most people agree that part one from 2017 is the better of the two. And so I was looking at, like, what do I feel is lacking in part two? And it seems like it's a stringing together of scares rather than what the book is really about: intergenerational trauma and bigotry and
friendship.
And friendship, yeah. And that was better with the kids, and with the adults that didn't quite gel to the same degree. But it just feels like the movie, missed the... It is a hangout story, But it's not just about a string of scares. It's about people exploring what really drives their fear, and it's often bigotry.
Yeah, I, you know, putting together what you two are saying, you know, the heart of Stephen King is the relationships and the day in the life stuff, right? And they did not have that in the second movie, in the 2019 movie, because they put everyone on these single person quests, right? They said, you go on your quest, right. you go on your quest to find your, I forgot what it was, token or something. And that kind of took away that day in the life thing. And, you know, that's also something I talk about with what we've lost in like sitcoms and more casual shows with the 8 to 10 episode season. You know, you don't have those extra 10 episodes to really breathe and have like, I don't know, we went to get ice cream that day and something silly happened, you know? It's a shame. But we'll see.
I feel like they knew that the emotional heart was stronger in the first film. And so in the second film, there are a lot of those flashbacks to them as kids, but most of those flashbacks to them as kids are a scare, right? Not to Alicia's point. Like not, I think there's one like, or a couple where it's like the hangout down in their underground little thing or whatever it was, but it's not the same, but you could almost tell that they knew that these adults weren't going to have the same kind of day in the life feeling, because they are all on these missions and they're coming back with the express purpose to kill this monster, right? And so you lose that, whereas the book, it's woven together, right? So
I think the 1990 movie did that better with the adult stuff, because even like it was so stupid, but in the 1990 movie there's just a scene with is it Bill and Mike riding on the bike together, and it's silly, but you know, I need that to be invested in the adult versions of them.
So have you seen that recently also?
Mm-hmm. I rewatched that recently
too. Yeah, see, I haven't seen that in a couple decades. So I hopefully by the end of the season, I'll rewatch that. I've seen obviously the It movies just in general are more recent, but I've seen those more, much more recently than that. John, what about you? Have you seen the 90s one?
I've not seen the 90s movie. Maybe I will, but so we're going to talk about the background on the show in a minute, but you know, this is directly connected to these movies and the 2017 and 2019 movies rather than the book or the 1990 movie. So that's why I was just focusing on the movies for now.
Right.
So before we get into more spoilery stuff, we're going to keep getting more spoiler as we go along, but I just wanted to give everyone to give their spoiler free hot take on the show, because this is a horror show. I think people can be hesitant to jump into horror shows. You know, with good reason. There's sometimes different levels of horror, different types of horror that people are sensitive to. And so I just wanted everyone to give their hot take on both, you know, the quality of the show and the, you know, the Pukila scale, the gore level.
Oh my.
Things that might upset you. So Alicia, why don't you start?
I mean, as I said earlier, basically this does feel like a deeply Stephen King show. So you need to be on board with like the icky, squicky, not just bloody stuff, but just kind of gross human body stuff. Yeah, I'm trying not to be
body horror
here. Yeah, body horror, but yeah. I like the, I think it's interesting. Obviously, we don't have quite a, not really a spoiler to say the first episode does not have Pennywise as we know it. No Bill Skarsgård yet. We know he's coming later this season. I like the form that they use instead, you know, that it really is terrifying and where it comes from. The whole opening scene for me was perhaps my favorite part of this episode. So, overall, I am intrigued by this start. It's hard to say this without spoileriness, but the way the episode ends, it's like, okay, well, now you have to kind of reinvest me to a certain degree. So I'm very curious to see how that happens with episode two. You guys know I was supposed to go to the theater and see the first two episodes already, but I ended up not being able to do that. So I still have only seen episode one, and I'm very curious where they take it from here.
Well, they are actually going to release episode two early on Halloween instead of waiting until Sunday, so you don't have to wait too long.
Okay.
Mark, your hot take and your spoiler free hot take plus your gore warning.
Gore warning is extremely high. I would say gore warning is higher for this than the film on some level. I don't remember exactly, but it's pretty shock value high, I would say, especially in the beginning of the show. My hot take overall, like it. We're going to have to talk about the timeline thing, because a lot of this, I think Alicia mentioned earlier, is inspired by the backstory that's in the novels, and in a sort of frame that we can maybe talk about a little bit without spoiling it. But I can see where they're going with some of that stuff, like how some of these historical things are going to be maybe the subject of some of these episodes, or even these whole seasons. But it's interesting because it's all about 30 years shifted in the timeline, and so that's going to have some natural implications on things. So I'm really fascinated. I can see a little bit where they're going, and I'm really here for it. I kind of disagree. I feel like the first scene is like, I have questions, I guess. I have some issues with it and some questions. The first scene, meaning just sort of the first set piece. I love it up until a point, and then I think it's maybe too much. And not just in the gore, but sort of in... It confuses me a little bit. It feels very... Is it Muschietti? Muschietti? How do we pronounce?
I looked it up. I think it's Muschietti.
Muschietti.
I mean, so. I would assume that it was based on you know, Italian pronunciation, but I'm pretty sure I've heard them say Muschietti in videos.
You know, Italian pronunciation.
Americanized. No, he's not actually not. He has an accent. So anyway, I don't know, but I'm pretty sure they say Muschietti.
Because they Italian pronunciation, we should say bruschetta, but we all say bruschetta in America, right? Because we don't treat the CH the same when we Americanize
it. Yourself.
So, I do, and people look at me like a weirdo. So
and then the British make fun of us, and then they go, taco.
Taco, yeah, like, love it.
You know what? You don't even get to make fun of me anymore.
So I guess it felt very true to his directing style, and also his sort of over-reliance maybe on CG. Like, I think some of the scares, even that iconic first scene in the first It film, where Georgie Dembrow gets pulled under, right? Under the sewer. It's this really beautifully well-done scene. And then Pennywise opens his mouth and he has got these cartoonish jaws, kind of like a video game boss. And even that film, and I really like the first It film from 2017, in my opinion, just the visuals cross the line into goofy just a little bit. And that's really much more true. And again, just my opinion, really much more true in the second It film, Chapter 2, that just almost too over the top to be scary, kind of in a Kill Bill kind of violence where it's goofy. So like, while I said that it's maxed out on the Pukila scale, I would say in terms of gore, it's almost like you're playing Mortal Kombat from the 90s. So it's less disturbing than a more realistic depiction of gore, in my opinion. And, you know, hot take is I'm hoping that that doesn't compromise the show, but I liked it so far.
Yeah, I said to you too, you know, I was a little bit let down by it, but the more I started looking into the background of the show, the more I have hope for the show. Because the first episode, it did feel to me like a repeat of the Losers Club from the movie, right? And I'll just say, you know, we've kind of been talking about it already, but just for now, just spoilers for the movies. We won't spoil the show yet. You know, it felt like they were just kind of retreading the Losers Club, retreading Georgie. And I'm glad sort of the way that the episode played out, because now it gives me excitement that something different is going to happen. And I would also agree that this is a very gore heavy show. Davey Mack said in our Discord, and I agree with this warning, some people are okay with some kinds of gore and others. There is graphic pregnancy related imagery that if you are bothered by that kind of thing, avoid it. At least skip the first couple scenes.
Right. I mean, you'll see it coming. Close your eyes.
Yeah, you know what's about to happen, so just skip forward two minutes when that happens. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So that's the only other warning I wanted to give. But overall, I think that this season has a lot of potential. I'm not like super sold on it yet, but it was a decent episode, and it could be the start of a really great season. We have 8 episodes, so we have a lot of runway now. So, background on show, and of course our first section will be shorter next week. We're just, you know, doing our introductory housekeeping. But the background on show, this was, oh man, now I don't know how to pronounce the name because we're debating it. I'll say Muschietti. So created by Andy and Barbara Muschietti, which are siblings, and Jason Fuchs, the Muschiettis. My God.
Muschietti.
All right. The Muschiettis were producers of the 2017 and 2019 It movies, and then Andy Muschietti directed them. The show is, of course, based on the characters and world of the 1986 Stephen King novel, It. King's novel was adapted into a 2-part TV miniseries in 1990, starring Tim Curry as Pennywise. The novel was then adapted as 2 movies in 2017 and 2019. Welcome to Derry is a prequel to this set of movies. So if you haven't seen those movies, you really should watch them before watching the show. I mean, it's vital background information. And this series, as Alicia mentioned, is in part based on the interludes from the original novel. So that's where they're pulling a lot of these situations from. Now, timeline-wise, I wanted to discuss this, that...
Wait, can I just jump in and say that I am wrong, and I looked it up, and they do seem to be saying Muschietti.
Muschietti.
Aha. Yeah.
Aha. So Wikipedia was right all along. All right. So the timeline, the movies take place, the current set of movies take place in the 1980s and the mid 2010s. The current show takes place in the early 1960s. But I wanted to mention that the original It novel takes place, the earlier part, in the late 1950s. So this is actually much closer in time to the original source material, which I think is kind of interesting.
I mean, I think just because of you and I, and I think you're also a fan, right, Mark? We are fans of Interview with the Vampire. Oh, yeah. And Interview with the Vampire, the TV show, they did something interesting with shifting the timelines there that actually, I think, made it a stronger show. And so I go into this with the timeline shift with a lot of good faith, because it looks like they are really paying attention to the details of the time in which it is set. And if you can make that feed the plot, if right. you can make that integral to the storytelling, then I think that makes the story all the stronger.
I think I would say, first of all, I think the comparison to Interview with the Vampires changes is great. And that one, without getting too much into it, there was a central premises about one of the characters' sort of life situation and the setting they wanted that necessitated that, right? They wanted Storyville in the early 20th century, which right. is just so different from, what is it, 1700s version of Louisiana? Right. They wanted that different. They wanted a black character living in the South in the early 20th century, and that is necessitated a very different time. This one, I feel like the choice really goes back to the films. And I think whether it's the Stranger Thingsification of this, which is really interesting, snake eating its own tail, since Stranger Things is really owes so much to it, they wanted the sense of nostalgia of the childhood era. And the way to capture that in the 2010s was not with the 50s, but with the 80s, right? They didn't want 2 period pieces, because the novel is half a period piece, right? The kids are 30 years ago or 27 years ago, and the adults are supposed to feel like now, right? It's set when the reader is reading the book in the 1980s, right? That feeling, if you do 50s and 80s in the 2017 film, then it's like double nostalgia. There's nothing that feels contemporary. And so what we're dealing with now is the consequences, not in a negative sense, but the result of that, right? We have to go back one generation of the cycle before that, right? So it's kind of a coincidence, I guess, that we end up essentially in the same era as the original novel, which has all sorts of implications. But I think it's the chasing of that nostalgia period piece thing that was a choice Muschietti, now I'm forgetting which it is, Muschietti made when doing Muschietti. That original film, right? I'm guessing that that's all it is. And they chose to go with that canon for probably, you know, just reasons of continuity with the brand right now, instead of the novel canon. Like, this is not an example of the Watchmen TV series, which,
right,
as I recall, is a sequel to the book, not to the film, right? It's that really only matters in one key moment in the ending of the book/film, but definitely a different scenario than this one.
Right. Yeah, I think that's all right. I think that, you know, they didn't want multiple period pieces. And now they're making a show with multiple period pieces, which is going to be super fun.
Right. Yeah. But they can keep going back. I mean, minor spoilers for the nature of it, but they can keep going back for centuries if they wanted to, if they got the runway to do so.
Well, that is what I was going to bring up now, which is that there is actually a 3-season plan for this show.
Mm-hmm.
I was not aware of this till I started looking into it, but they intend to do the first season, this one in 1962, the second in 1935, and the third in 1908. So they're going back 27 years each time.
Does someone want to read this quote? Because this quote is a little concerning, and I really hope it's tongue in cheek.
Why is it concerning? Because
let's read the quote first.
Okay.
Mark, you know what? You brought it up. Why don't you read it?
Can I add my own hilarious emphasis, or do I have to read it straight-faced? You want to know why I think it's concerning? Let me read it. This is a quote from Andy Muschietti in an interview with CBR. You also get a glimpse into the bigger mythology for people who love the book or love the movies. We're opening a window. Everything that we are setting up in season one, that will really manifest in 2 and 3, is a look into all the bigger questions about it. What does it want? Why is it here? All the cryptic elements of it that we're going to ruin and explain.
Okay, and maybe poor choice of words.
Oh, yeah.
It better be, because you do learn some backstory of it in it, and you learn in the Dark Tower and stuff. You don't learn more about it, but you kind of get a sense more for how this would fit into the larger universe. And some of that stuff is almost so off topic that I could probably spoil it in this podcast, and it has zero consequence on anything. But there is also just this fundamental, almost Cthulhu level incomprehensibility of this entity, right?
Mm-hmm.
The deadlights, like, there's this whole thing in the book of, like, the true essence of it is almost incomprehensible, right? And so I really hope they don't go, like, look, do I want to see its arrival in our, you know, in Derry? Like, of course I do. But also I feel a little bit like, watch what you wish for. It's probably better to let the mystery be, as the, you know, theme song from The Leftovers kept saying, right? I don't know. Do you two disagree with me there?
I think that I know, like, you know, like I said at the opening, I'm only just now actually starting the novel, but I do actually know a lot about it, because it's just one of those things you absorb, you know, from being a fan of the movies and hearing comparisons. And so I know that the movies left this stuff out. Basically, it was like, let's just mostly shy away from the cosmic stuff. They put a bit in part two. But I think in part two, that is one of the things that somewhat weakened it, because they didn't explain it enough. So I am one who tends to be more like, if you have interesting mythology, explain it to us, because I enjoy that part. I understand other people shy away, but regardless, there definitely needs to be a balance struck. And I think they lean too far away from it in the movies. So I'm glad, with quotes like this, and also with the fact that the turtles keep popping up in the first episode, it assures me that they are going to, lean into it a bit more.
And I think when we talk about the turtle, I think that's an example of something that I can sort of, quote, spoil that doesn't matter. But it's a great example. Like, if we get the backstory for the turtle, this thing is going to be, oh my God, that's awful. But but even having read all of The Dark Tower, like, I know just enough about the turtle to be so fascinated by the concept of the turtle, but I want more, and that's probably better than the biopic they make, you know, with Timothée Chalamet playing the turtle, right? And then I know every single thing about the turtle, right? And yeah, so
Does the turtle sing in this biopic? Sorry.
Yeah, 100%. Would I read Stephen King, if Stephen King had written a Pennywise book that explained every single minute of Pennywise's life, would I read that? Of course I would read that. But we're probably, I feel like I'm better off without it, right? I think it's one of those scenarios. Like, I want to know, but the wanting to know is part of the fun. And I think just the glimpse, like, not to keep bringing up the Dark Tower, but by the Dark Tower, things get so crazy. The cosmology is so exploded that you know so much, but you just immensely have this feeling like, I still don't know enough. And I think that's, there's beauty in that, right? I think the best fantasy worlds, which this is really, leave a lot of room that, you know, if this were Star Wars, other people would start making films in this universe, right? And stuff like that. And it's just kind of endlessly full. And I love that. And so I really do think plundering the interludes, which is, there's a librarian character doing research about it. That's fundamentally, without spoiling, I mean, what, he's in the, one of the kids grows up.
Yeah, Mike.
Mike Hanlon grows up to be the Lighttown librarian. And he's the only one in at chapter two, people may remember, he's the only one who still remembers that this happened because he stayed in Derry, right? And we can maybe talk about why later. But he does research, and there's little interludes. I mentioned Watchmen, kind of in the same way that Watchmen has these interludes in the graphic novel where they're not even graphic novels. They're just like prose and like news articles explaining the history of it. I love that this show is going to explain and make those things real, some of them. But if they go more than that, you know, why it is here and let's ruin it and like, I really hope that's a joke. That's all I'm saying. And I know I'm taking like half our podcast talking about this point, but I hope it's a joke.
I do think it is. I think it's kind of somebody who's doing a backstory for a mythical and mysterious character, basically like nodding to the fact that that is what people fear, right? That's what I would read it as.
He's being it.
My worst fear. Yeah, my it encounter is Pennywise being spoiled. That's so funny. No, it would be aliens. Definitely aliens. Anyways, go ahead.
All right. So the first episode, the pilot, which we're discussing today, was written by Jason Fuchs, directed by Andy Muschietti. And Muschietti is directing at least the first four episodes so far. And Fuchs wrote this episode, the finale, and wrote two others in collaboration with others. So this is going to be the team we're with for the long haul. And so I'm glad we at least are with that. And I enjoy, I don't know about you two, but I do enjoy when there's continuity in the writing team and writing and directing team.
Right. Probably. And continuity from the film. So these are people who are just very, especially Andy Muschietti, he's very invested in this story, right? He and his sister.
Right. All right, well, we've done our intro. We're 40 minutes in. So let's go take a break, and we'll come back and recap the episode.
Hi, Alicia from the Lorehounds here. I'm genuinely excited about this new sponsor we're working with this fall because they've played an important role in my family's holidays and special events for many years now. I'm talking about Uncommon Goods, my and my family's favorite place to buy gifts for each other. Their official tagline is, Uncommon Goods makes holiday shopping stress-free and joyful with thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts you can't find anywhere else, which is absolutely true. But if you know me at all, you know that I get excited about unique, quirky products made by artisans and other creative people. I just personally love scrolling through their website and stumbling across such specific items I'd never find anywhere else. Over the years, I've gotten everything from personalized puzzles to retro viewfinders with family photos to beer brewing or wine aroma kits. And my latest purchase is a 3-in-1 convertible bag. It's a gift for my mom to thank her for everything she's done to help me through my tougher moments. And I'm getting started on my holiday shopping earlier this year, too. Need to make sure that I leave plenty of time for gifts to arrive with the recent unpredictability in shipping. If you're thinking the same, then good news. We can offer you a 15% discount when you shop on Uncommon Goods and drop our name. So shop early, have fun, and cross some names off your list today. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/lorehounds. That's uncommongoods.com/lorehounds for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods, we're all out of the ordinary.
Before we recap the episode, can I just say one clarifying thing? Because I feel like I've been talking about the Dark Tower without explaining why I keep talking about the Dark Tower. For the uninitiated, Stephen King novels, almost all of them, take place in the same continuity. And that includes anything from a vampire novel like Salem's Lot to It to the Shawshank Redemption short story, Rita Hayworth and the Shawshank Redemption, which has zero supernatural elements, but happens in a prison that happens to be up in Maine near a lot of the other interactions we know, in Stephen King.
We saw in the trailer a bus that said Shawshank Redemption on the side. Or not Redemption, Shawshank, but Shawshank Prison.
Yeah. So, so the reason I keep mentioning Dark Tower is because Dark Tower is this sort of magnum opus of Stephen King in the sense that he wrote it starting in the 70s all the way until 2000s when he almost died in a car accident and he went, oh my gosh, I have to finish this. And so he pumped out the last couple novels. And the reason I mention it is because it kind of is the hinge point that the cosmology revolves around. So it's kind of a fantasy Western in terms of its vibe, but it's it's interdimensional travel kind of multiverse stuff. So it's not that the story of the Dark Tower has anything to do with it. It's that the Dark Tower is the proof that this is all one continuity, right? So you can kind of intersect in the Dark Tower. You intersect with It. You intersect with Salem's Lot. You intersect with so many of the different properties, sometimes just through Easter eggs, sometimes with actual character overlap. And so I just wanted to put that out because I sort of have been referring to it as if people knew that, and there's zero reason to think people know that.
That's a fair clarification, and I appreciate it. I'm wondering if they're leading to a Dark Tower series on HBO.
We know that Mike Flanagan, the Stephen King whisperer, is working on something in that sphere. So
is it for Warner Brothers HBO?
Was it for, I feel like it was for Prime, but I have to look that up.
I hope it's for HBO. I think,
yeah, it would just be nice if it all tied in together, you know?
I happen to be a fan of the Flanagan King adaptations. Even the some of them are films I haven't read the book of, but I just enjoy his horror style. I also like his, you know, House on Haunted Hill star. What is it? Haunting of Hill House? I'm trying to remember which one it is. They all have, there's a few different adaptations.
Yeah, The Haunting of Hill House, yeah. I think it's the best one.
That's strong.
Of his, but also The Fall of the House of Usher was a great one.
That was,
which is not Stephen King, but, or nor is The Haunting of Hill House.
Right, sure. Matter. But cool stuff.
It's expected to be on Prime.
We'll see if it gets canceled three seasons in. If that's a show that you, a thing that probably has to be a show, it can't be a film or a series of films. Mm-hmm. We saw what happened when they did the film a decade or so ago. Anyways, we can get back to the episode, but.
Let's get into the main episode. So the first section, Goodbye, Maddie. Alicia, do you want to read the recap?
Sure. In 1962, Maddie Clements gets caught sneaking into a movie and escapes with the help of Ronnie Grogan. He tries to hitchhike away from Derry and is picked up by a seemingly perfect nuclear family who promises to take him to Portland. The family's actions continue to get stranger and scarier until the mother gives violent birth to a demonic flying baby. The baby attacks Maddie and the family laughs as the car arrives back in Derry.
I mean, you know, when you write it down, it is a ridiculous scene.
Yeah. I mean, very Stephen King.
Mark, your thoughts on this scene?
So I think the setup is awesome. I think it's classic, you know, kids versus the town kind of setup that part of the situation is that the adults, there's just like atrocities happening and the adults kind of are ignoring it. And this kid, whatever is going on in Matt's life, he doesn't have anybody there for him. And I think, or Maddie's life. I think it's a really nice setup. Like I said, I think it goes a little too over the top. My issues with it, actually, a lot of it has more to do with a fan of the story, because I'm kind of like just expecting the CG to be a little over the top. I don't know if you want me to get into it. I feel like I'm starting off the podcast sounding pretty negative, but I really enjoyed almost everything else in this episode. It just has implications for the characters that I'm confused by, and we can talk through, but we can come back to that after everybody's sort of said their takes about this setup. Alicia, you seem to really like the opening, right?
Yeah. Yeah, for me, it's the strongest part. I, you know, as I said, I'm only a few chapters into the book. So as far as the further implications it has, I'm not really up on that. So I suppose maybe that gives me less reason to object. Mm. But I just really like the atmosphere that it creates and where it just starts seeming, because that's a good Pennywise scare, is something that seems very normal. And then just slowly gets weirder and weirder until you're like, this is, and then you realize, and just being trapped in the car, it's this cage and you're trapped inside the cage with the monsters. And just at what point, it's like we were just talking about Barbarian and about also Bill Skarsgård, and about how that opening part of Barbarian is all about listening to the red flags. And here it's with a Pennywise scare, it is like red flag. Wait, that's not right. No, wait, that's, and you know, and then suddenly there's the dawning horror and it's too late. And presumably, I mean, you might know differently, but at this point it looks like Maddie's dead.
Well, have either of you been in a situation where somebody was flirting with you by rubbing raw liver on your face? Because
that's when it started to get weird.
That's a red flag. I would say, I would think it's a red flag. Yeah.
Yeah. Literally red.
Mm. John, before I trash it more, John, what do you think about this opening?
No, I thought it was good. I was a little like, okay, we're redoing Georgie. We got the one kid going missing. But, you know, it's deeper than that, right? Like, we have, you know, I think somebody said it's a normal situation. And I will say, it's shocking how much more common hitchhiking was back then. And I remember my grandpa telling me, yeah, you know, every time I got home from the Navy on leave, I would just hitchhike home. And I was like, what are you talking about? Like, we're just getting into strangers' cars all the time.
I remember my father would pick up hitchhikers while I was there a lot.
Wow. It's kind of funny, too, because there was almost a vibe of like, oh, where are you going? It's like, okay, well, I guess this is my family now. There was almost a vibe of them being just like, well, come with us. You're with us now. Which right. is really wild, and obviously that's part of it, right? It's not real.
There's two sides to that. One is like, okay, it's a little suspicious to begin with that the family is like, oh, when we ask you where you live, you're like, just take me out of Derry. Like, no, you go to the authorities after that. Like, you bring the kid to Child Protective Services, especially if the kid has signs of physical abuse, has the pacifier.
What's up with the pacifier? What do we think? Just a coping?
I think it's just a soothing.
Self-soothing, yeah.
Yeah, it's a soothing.
But I mean, but again, I don't know. I wasn't alive in 1962, but I don't know if Child Protective Services was quite the same thing.
Well, that was my second point, is that we as a nation, at least, did not really confront the reality of child abuse until like the 80s. And I do think that it's plausible in 1962 that people were like, well, let's just get the kid out of here. You know, there's two levels to it. There's the current thing of like, oh my God, I got to get this kid to, you know, protective services. But also the level of like, hey, this is the 60s. It's a different world. And things are a little less regulated, right? Things are a little less, there's fewer proper channels you're going through. Also, like, you don't have a cell phone, you know, things are just so different, where today you could just call an Uber or you can call, you know, anybody. Whereas here he has got to rely on whoever sees his finger pointing in the direction he wants to go.
Okay.
But anyway, I did enjoy the scene. I think, I kind of agree with Mark. The CGI was like less than great, but, the family itself, I thought, all acted very well. Like, they were all very subtle, yes, in their slow descent into madness. And that's the Pennywise of it all.
So, right, exactly. That's what I want to ask about. And I'm not, it's not that I don't like it. It's just that I'm confused and worried that it's just doesn't make sense and we're going to be a little too loose. Because, whatever, I'm not keeping them to the continuity of the novel, right? I'm not keeping them to the canon of the novel, but I feel like I want to keep them to the canon of the films, right? They're telling me that I should be doing that, right? So what happened here? Tell me what actually happened here.
What do you mean, in what regard?
What happened to Maddie? Tell me, we don't see him die, but like, let's presume Maddie died, which we uh-huh. probably could assume, but maybe not. Yeah. We didn't see a body. What happened?
I mean, it could have been like that he crawled in some, to him, it looked like he got into a car, but he yeah. could have like crawled into a tree trunk or who knows, a doghouse or whatever. And Pennywise messed with him and killed him.
So I think this is, I guess, the question and the issue is like, this isn't me trying to come up with rules for the magic system or anything, like we're playing tabletop RPG, but Pennywise can do illusions and Pennywise can change form. And he does that, or it does that, based on your fears, right? So what does this have to do with, is this somehow relevant to Maddie's worst fears? Like, that's a little weird, but like, I guess we could say, okay, a nuclear family that's bad is Maddie's worst fear. Okay, so, because that's how Pennywise gets you, right? He feeds,
right?
The term in the novel is fear salts the meat. So like, if Pennywise mm-hmm. is going to eat you, it's better if it's a kid, and it's better if the person is really afraid. So that's why he transforms into all the kids in the films, like scary, the thing they're most afraid of, right? So let's just take Maddie is afraid of a nuclear family gone wrong. Did Pennywise create a car that is an entire illusion and elusively transport him driving through the city? Like, this doesn't really fit sure. with what, but that doesn't, we haven't seen Why any not? Exhibition of, because where's Maddie's like, body, right?
It's like when Beverly in It Part, Chapter 2, it's like when she, you know, and this is also from the book and stuff, she goes into her old house and she thinks she's had this whole interaction with this woman there.
And Kirsch, yeah.
And Kirsch. And
but she's then in some
she
building,
goes outside
right?
the house and looks back, and the house was this burnt down, boarded
right,
up thing.
Yeah.
So she obviously wasn't, this was a full illusion that she was inhabiting. Right. So I think this is the same level as that, more or less.
I guess to me, it's just way further level. Like, which thing is Pennywise? Is Pennywise, like, okay, sure, Pennywise maybe can split into four people plus a demonic baby, but and a car. Is Pennywise a car driving around, or is he sitting cowering in the corner? Like, I think that's the thing that gets me.
I don't think Pennywise was the apartment in the illusion with Beverly that I was just talking about either. I think he's just like got, you know, to put it in Marvel terms, he's got Scarlet Witch powers. He can make people see things.
So Bev was in an apartment, an abandoned building, thinking it was this mm-hmm. apartment with this monstrous lady. I guess it's just, this is an expansion, put it this way, because it's an illusion, but this is just a level of illusion that I think it's really just the fact that they're driving around town and that probably, I guess I just want to know, did that actually happen? Or was, as you said, I think I buy it more if Maddie crawled into a tree trunk and is not hallucinating, but having an illusion of this entire experience. Or is there actually a person, right? Because we see with like Henry Bowers, the bully characters, there are people that are doing Pennywise's bidding. Like, is there a man driving around this car and Pennywise, like, I guess it's just, without that, it's just a little, it makes me nervous that they're just sort of stretching it. I hope that you're right, that we can just say this just counts as an illusion, and you know, and this is just an order of magnitude more complicated than what Beverly was hallucinating in It Chapter 2. If this is a story about explaining Pennywise, let's keep it sort of manageable in, don't over explain into ways that then contradict other things. That's, I guess, my concern. And the rest of this didn't follow down that path. It was totally tight after this moment.
I don't see it as any different in magnitude from the whole Beverly apartment experience. Like, it just, you know, it's just about manifesting, because it wasn't like they were driving past anything interesting either. It was just dark, road at night. Yeah. So it wasn't a complicated illusion overall. But I think I can tell you and I are definitely going to come at this question of them explaining things from different angles. So that, that should be interesting for listeners.
And I think maybe it's a filmmaking thing also, like that scene you mentioned in it, chapter two ends with, or something like ends with her turning around and realizing what she was in. I think it's just like if I, and obviously we don't see what happened to Maddie until we see him later in the film, right, which, you know, isn't him, obviously, in the regular sense. In the film, when I mean in the theater, right? So maybe it's just sort of like I, as a viewer, needed some kind of, because it was breaking what I thought was the capabilities of the monster, some kind of reassurance that, oh, it's just an illusion. It's like, or like, nah, man, Pennywise can turn into a car. And like, maybe I can buy that. Like, but I guess that's something that, maybe you're exactly right, that it's just a difference in, not harping on the novel as much as like what they've set up in the other films. So, yeah, like I said, after this point, everything felt pretty tight to what they've established this monster can do. And we're just assuming babies and nuclear families that are creepy are something relevant to Maddie's experience that would cause him, you know, he has telltale signs of an abusive family or something, and the greatest fear is not a father figure or like a like a mean or, you know, violent father that we would have with some other characters. So that's an interesting change from that.
I read it as his fear is finally escaping, but he didn't really escape.
Interesting.
Right? Yep. And he finally felt this sense of safety for a minute. You could see him have this sigh of relief as he leans against the window and he's just, you know, oh my God, I'm finally getting out of Derry. And by the way, guy's probably seen some things. I don't think it's limited to the abuse. I think that they were suggesting that he's had an encounter with Pennywise before. Because he goes to get me out of Derry, right? Anywhere out of Derry. And so I think it's just that Pennywise rips that relief away from him, rips that safety away from him. That's his fear.
Isn't there also implications that Pennywise kind of, because there are a lot of abusive parents in Derry, and I feel like there are implications that Pennywise kind of influences the adults to be more corrupt and abusive as well.
I don't know enough, but I could see it.
I think at the very least, Pennywise, the influence of Pennywise on Derry is that people turn a blind eye to things, right? There's entire murders and things like that, that kind of, like, we see it. The kids are looking through the microfiche and, like, learning the details of this murder, but this isn't just already apparent on everybody's mind. It's not like everybody's talking about it, right? It gets reported on and forgotten. And so I think there's malevolent influence that Pennywise has on people, especially the adults. But I think the turning a blind eye to it is, and the acceptance of it is even the most striking difference. And that is an effect that you could really connect to the sort of survival skills that Pennywise has.
Right. Yeah, I mean, to me, I guess Pennywise and it's just a soft magic system. It always appeared to me from the movies. I never read the book and I was not really bothered by the parameters of this haunting. I was just like, okay, that was spooky.
The whole universe is a soft magic system. 100%. All the Stephen King verse for sure.
We're not going to talk about channeling capacity, like the Wheel of Time.
That's right. Yeah. Ranking them. Yeah, that's right. What power level is Pennywise? Yeah. Plus 17.
Yeah. Yeah. Somewhere between Cadsuane and no.
Yeah. Rest in peace.
Oh.
Yeah.
Someday we'll see Cadsuane on screen. Wheel of Time. Savewatt.com.
I'm going to let you live in that Delulu land, Alicia, alone. All right. Let's go to the military base. Mark, tell me what happened there.
4 months later, Major Leroy Hanlon arrives at the Derry Air Force Base to begin testing B-52 bombers alongside his friend, Captain Polly Russo. While most of his welcome is warm, one soldier is outwardly racist towards him. Thankfully, General Francis Shaw disciplines the racist soldier, whose name is Masters, I believe, and promises Hanlon that there will be no tolerance for that behavior. That night, he is attacked by a team of masked men demanding he provide the details for the B-52 he's testing. Polly bursts through the door, giving Hanlon an opening and allowing them to send away the attackers. So
I had some issues with this scene. I was like, all right, you got attacked. I understand you were getting overpowered, but like, why didn't you raise the alarm afterward? Like, you just let him walk away. Like, I understand you couldn't fight them all, you know, to submission yourself, but like, you don't go and like, there's got to be an alarm system here, right? It's a military base.
Yeah. I mean, it depends who is in on it. Presumably someone who can disable that.
But they don't even try, right? Like, you didn't show me that. They just sit there and are like, oh, that was crazy, huh? And they like chuckle about it. And you're like, huh?
As opposed to, this is deeply concerning. Let's go tell everybody. Yeah, that is interesting.
Maybe that's, it's magic, right? Like, you're already forgetting about it.
Right. That's true, too. That could have to do with it. And I mean, and I also wonder if it has to do with, there's implications that there are some sort of mysterious activities. That there is a part of the base where, and I got really fascinated by the driver. They just silently show this. So this other black man who's a driver, who is given the looks of like, like, there's stuff you need to know. And so, you know, he's going to tell stuff. And so I had to look up who is the driver, and it's Dick Halloran. Speaking of overlap. So do you want to say who Dick Halloran is?
I did not know that.
So I thought about saying maybe we shouldn't say this, but I think it's in the trailer, basically.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, he's credited also, so.
Yeah. Yeah. Dick Halloran, of course. See, I know this one because I actually went to Shining. Go for it. He is the, I believe he was the chef at the Overlook Hotel. And he's the one who teaches, man, it's been a while since I read The Shining. He teaches the kid
Danny
about Shining. He teaches Danny, He teaches Danny about what Shining is.
Which
all
is
all about his powers.
Psychic powers, basically. So he ends up in Colorado at a point later than this. I don't remember when The Shining takes place. 70s, maybe? That's fascinating. That's right. So, like, are those looks about, oh, you don't even know, this place is crazy? Or are those looks like, I'm psychically reading the people here and that's what's crazy, right? Because he has psychic powers. Yeah,
when this mysterious place comes up where, I forget exactly what they say, but sort of like, don't worry about what's going on behind door number two. That's when I first noticed he gives a look like, do worry about that, actually. Mm. So, yeah, and right, I do wonder.
Mm-hmm. At the same time, he does, he gives Hanlon the look right after the racist interaction, right?
Right,
so
that too.
You have to, you can read it two ways. You can read it as, I am a fellow black service member, and I'm like, this is the way it is. But you know what I mean? Like, he's trying to warn him. I at first, before I knew, I didn't know it was Dick Halloran the first time I watched it. And then when I was researching the show, I was like, oh, it is Dick Halloran. But for me, I thought it was him warning Hanlon that the general might seem like he's fighting the racism, but he's not really, you know, like, he's actually in on it. Right. And, but no, I think you could read it two ways, that way, or, hey, some shit's going down here supernaturally.
Mm-hmm. Can it be both? But that also would explain the, you know, why they don't really do much about it.
Right. So this is really interesting to me because, like, a lot of the elements here, we have to be super wait and see. Because I could believe, because of who Dick Halloran is, and we know that he has magical powers from the film The Shining, or rather the book The Shining, this could either be an Easter egg. Oh, wow, a chapter in his life, and it just doesn't matter. Or he could be instrumental in this, and really it's not clear, you know, because this, you know, the other element is, this is something that I think, a thread from one of the novel interludes, because one of them, soldiers are an aspect to the backstory, right? So I already think in my head from reading the book, like, okay, I have some ideas of where this is going, but that's just the librarian Mike reading an article, and there's no mention, oh, and there was the driver who was the psychic Dick Halloran. So, right. Like, we don't know. It could be completely cohesive with the canon of the novel. We just don't have any of the information, although the dates are shifted, right? And the other element that's wait and see is this mysterious, oh, are they doing secret experiments? I mean, is this another Stranger Thingsification thing where, like, this is the, what are they called? What's the organization that's like set up shop studying the upside down? I don't remember, but like, oh, is this something like that? Or is this also just set dressing and not an Easter egg, but just sort of like doesn't matter because there's the larger thing that's going on that this aspect of the soldier's life doesn't really matter. So it's really interesting to kind of watch that. And to see if these things are just kind of expanding the world for the sake of it, or if they end up important.
All right, hear me out. MK Itra.
Well done. Ha. Nice. Is that an improvisation or was that prepared?
That was an improvisation. Nice. I'm off the cuff here.
So who do we think, when there are the three masked guys who attacked him, one of them didn't participate and seemed more reluctant. Do we think that that's someone we've already seen without a mask on?
It's Dick Halloran. No, it's probably not, but I don't know. I don't know. It certainly isn't Pauly. They took him out of the situation right away. Although I guess a question is, how did Pauly know how to come in? Did he just hear it? Is he the next room over and he just heard a commotion? Or was he in on it and he's trying to gain trust?
With not getting into spoilers, because this is fundamentally like, I don't know anything about this from the novel, but I do have innately a distrust for the general, because one thing that just comes up in a lot of King novels that involve the 50s and the 60s, you know, so many things are set in Maine, right? He's from Bangor, and so Derry is kind of like a fictionalized demonic version of Bangor, Maine, is this idea that keeps showing up in King work that is, yeah, we don't have segregation up here, but there's racists up here. And that happens in the It novel with Mike, the kid. And then, you know, as he grows up, it happens in the films. It's alluded to, not as much, but I don't think, I'm guessing this show is not going in the direction of, yeah, there's this one racist and he was beaten down by the upstanding general. And so
the righteous white savior.
That's right. I cannot help but think, I'm not saying General Shaw is one of the masked guys, but I can't help but wonder, these aren't Russian spies trying to like get B-52. This is like an intimidation tactic to try to get him to like spill the beans. And then they can say, look, you betrayed our confidence, you know, and let's court martial him. Like, I don't know any of that, as this is none of that is spoiler from reading it, but I feel like it's an inside job kind of thing. I just think this is that kind of story. It's not Stranger Things intrigue about what's going on behind that base. I don't think. I think that's all setting up a mystery that's really going to be a story about Derry and the brokenness of the town, culturally, right? And of, you know, American society in the 60s. But I don't know.
No, I think you're absolutely right. For me, I agree with you. It would be disappointing if that was just like a morality play on racism for like 3 minutes, right? So I would like it to be something bigger than that. I would like them to actually explore that theme if they're going to bring it in, instead of just, you know, having a one-off, like you say, like the white savior comes in and is like, well, no, he's disciplined and we don't tolerate that here. I too am very suspicious of the general, but I almost want it to not be the general, because that's the most obvious guy, right? That's the most obvious culprit. Right.
Well, it's weird though, because the general, let's say it's not the general, because it's too obvious from a filmmaking perspective. the theme, and I'm curious if this actually literally is in Derry or outside of Derry, the theme of adults and authority figures ignoring villainous activity and ignoring bad things is not consistent with the general intervening, very much intervening on behalf of this soldier. So that's a little weird, right? Like, what is he the one? Not that there's no good adults in Derry, but it definitely breaks the trend to have this sort of like goodly, righteous defender of justice amongst his subordinates. It much more in keeping with the town that there would be rampant racism that is ignored by the superior officers. So is that a tell also that this is somehow different, or is this 2 miles outside the town borders and so Pennywise has no control? Like, I don't know. Something
it's a good
to watch.
Question. I mean, to me, I would say the way I've understood Pennywise's magic to work is, sure, it'll let you overlook things, like overlook signs of things, like you could ignore Maddie's bruises. But if the child abuse were happening in front of you, you wouldn't be able to ignore it, right? You'd say, hey, stop that, and you'd stop the person.
Right. They still investigate a crime. They still put someone in jail. Then they just all forget about it moments later.
Right. The news story comes out, and then and then over time you forget about it. So I think it tracks. I think it's still fine if he sees it and he goes, hey, that's not cool, you know? I guess we'll see. I got my eye on the general. Obviously, we have to keep an eye on the guy who actually made the racist comments. And did he make a comment, or did he kind of just stay silent? You know what I mean? Racist withholding of a salute.
Can we, before we move on, just like take a nod to who Leroy Hanlon might be? So Mike Hanlon is the one of the losers and the one who grows up to be the librarian, who, in my opinion, is not given enough in the films. Like he's not one of the most active characters in the novel in terms of doing stuff, but he is kind of the framing device in a lot of ways because he's the librarian. And I feel like they left too much of that off in the films because they had to cater to the action and the big set pieces. So it's really cool to see presumably a member of the family. And
we know it's his grandfather. His grandfather appeared in the film.
Got it. So because there's a kid, he has a kid, right? And that's got to be Mike's dad or something, maybe. Isn't there a kid of this, of Leroy's that appears or is referred to or something? I'm trying to remember.
Right. And then in 20 something years, he'll grow up and have his own kid. So he said that his family is coming, but I don't think we haven't met.
Got
them
it. Okay. Right? So he just mentioned them. Mm-hmm. So that's interesting. Like, what is that, you know, is there some, you know, they have to be careful because there's another family connection that we'll talk about in another scene, but you know, is there some horrific traumatic event that happened to Mike Hanlon's grandfather that just never gets mentioned in the entire IT story? Like, oh, yeah, there's monsters. Oh, by the way, my grandfather was killed by a monster. So whatever happens either isn't something that would register with the family or is, of course, forgotten and swept under the rug, right? Whatever happens at the end of this plot line.
Right. Yeah, I'm in for all the connections.
Yeah.
Show me where Mike came from. Maybe not directly.
Well, when a mom and a dad really love each other.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Mark. I knew it was going to get there. As soon as I phrased it that way, I was like, oh, Mark's going to harp in on that.
Well-documented prude John, right?
All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we get back, we'll talk about the new Losers Club. All right, Teddy, Uris, and Phil Malkin disagree on whether their old, reluctant friend Maddie is still alive. Lily Bainbridge hears Maddie singing You Got Trouble from the Music Man from her bathroom drain, then sees Maddie's fingers come up through the drain. She confides in her friend Marge, and the two of them meet with Teddy and Phil to discuss what happened. The boys don't believe Lily until Teddy, spurred by his father's lecture about his ancestors suffering in the Holocaust, is haunted by a lampshade made of faces. The four kids meet up again to track down Maddie.
That lampshade made of faces. I mean, I should have seen it coming as soon as we heard what we heard before that. But good Lord, that was an effective scare, visual, sad thing.
That dad was a horrendous father. Just like, I mean, your kid comes to you feeling like clearly like grieving a friend. And he, well, maybe he didn't read it that way. He saw the comic book and just blamed it on that. But like, he just snaps at him and gives him a hard time and then trauma dumps.
The parents in this book suck.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is an interesting connection to the other story, right? And it's Teddy's family, right, somehow. And I think this is one of the ones where I think the stuff with the black soldier is affected by the time shift a little bit, because we're talking about the 60s as opposed to Jim Crow era, which is the 30s, which is sort of where the inspiration for that plot line would come from. But this is similar here, because Stan Uris, who's one of the losers, people may remember he's the one that doesn't make it really into It Chapter 2, because he kills himself when he realizes that he's supposed to go back. He's like the practical one, solutions oriented, but also fearful, more fearful than the rest of them about the monster, right? And that's too much for him as an adult. And Stan Uris, who is the same last name as Teddy Uris, who's the shorter of the two kids, the one who's more sort of obviously mourning Maddie, is pretty much described as the only Jewish kid in school, right? And one of the only Jewish families in school. And so it's just interesting to me, the shift here, because the original novel is set in a post-World War II, post-Holocaust context, where it's not said whether his family were, you know, immigrants or refugees or fleeing Eastern Europe or Central Europe from the Holocaust or anything like that. But what is clear is that they're not religious. Like, Stanley kind of barely knows anything about Judaism. And at least that's in the book. I don't remember if that comes. I don't think Stan's also kind of not given much in the film relative to the book. But what's interesting here is one of these kids Stanley's dad, Stanley's grandpa? Well, it's got to be Stanley's dad, and probably age-wise. But if so, this family is obviously coming from that post-Holocaust Jewish diaspora. I think there's Yiddish spoken at the table. So, like, it's the implication here is that the parents may have come from Europe in a post-World War II or during or right before World War II kind of situation, the 30s, fleeing the Nazis or something like that. And they are seemingly much more culturally Jewish, possibly even religious, right? In that they're doing the Baruch Adonai, like they're saying the prayers. Mm-hmm. And so what happens there? Who is Stanley's dad? Like, how does this family go from this scenario to having a kid who is still kind of the only Jewish kid in school, who again does not know or never brings up, hey, my uncle was brutally ripped apart in a movie theater. Like, it's,
I mean,
so,
yeah, it fits with this, the pattern.
Yeah. It's that's but, wild though.
But it does make sense to me that, you know, you do see in general, younger generations tend to disassociate from, especially when they're from a culture that makes them feel unique in town. Although there was this thing in the second movie where there was a funeral for Stan at the temple. So there was enough people in town that they had a temple. And it struck me like, it's funny they didn't invite any of his friends, but they probably don't even remember that he has friends.
Right.
Right. And, I mean, like Alicia said, like I don't really have a hard time believing that the children of religious people chose not to raise their kids religiously. But also, if your father was like a real dick and really insistent about it, you might do that out of rebellion, right? Sure. And his dad does not seem like a nice person and does not seem like a nice father. And then if you lost your brother in a traumatic way, maybe that, you know, some people respond to trauma in all different ways. And some people go closer to religion and some people distance themselves from religion, right? They say, how could my God have done this? And I think that it's perfectly reasonable for the next generation down to be you know, less religious. Maybe Stan's dad understood all the Jewish rituals, but he did not decide to teach his children less. I buy it.
Yeah, this is not me saying I don't buy it. It's just there's a story there. To have it be Stan's family, presumably because of the last name, there's a story there that's really significant that we're not going to know, or we will know, right? Because, and it's just the establishing that this is a multi-generational family in Derry, I don't think that's clear, and that there's multi-generational interactions with Pennywise in some ways, or it, the creature, Pennywise the clown doesn't appear, but is very much adding to what I think our understanding, because Stan's parents are not big characters in the novel and the films, right, in the same way that you see a lot of the other kids interacting with their families. Eddie in particular has a whole like trauma response with his mom, right? Go ahead.
But if I understand this correctly, then Pennywise is essentially like the town exists in a way because Pennywise kind of encouraged this thriving to have a food supply, more or less. And and Pennywise has been there for centuries. So I would assume that all of the families have rich histories with Pennywise, even if they couldn't fit them in that, what is it, 1,200 page book.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure we're going to see more connections too, because if the show is allowed to continue, we're going to have two more cycles of Pennywise to get through.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Pennywise, from a certain point of view, is Derry, right?
Right.
Because Pennywise doesn't seem to be able to leave, or at least Pennywise doesn't leave, that this is sort of Pennywise's nest on some level. So I think everybody generationally would. I think you're exactly right. I think what this shows is that family has a long history in Derry, whereas that wasn't... It's his... Stanley's positionality as a kind of other in Derry, in the same way that Mike, being the only black kid in school, their positionality is unique. And this is just giving us kind of both of them, really, like more. No, they were not only were they a part of Derry, but they might have been a part of it,
right,
in previous generations. And the religiosity and the change and the relation to the Holocaust, those are just things that are different because of the time period, right? So like, right, there's Stanley's family might have fled the Holocaust, but Stanley's grandparents, in the original book, his grandparents could not have, because his grandparents would have been in 1912 or whatever, right? Because Stanley was a kid in the 50s, whereas this looks like Stanley's dad is a kid in the 50s, right? So it just changes the sort of generational relationship to the Jewish kind of experience in the United States in an interesting way. Yeah.
But then that means, yeah, that the next season we have the generation before that that's more what you're thinking of. But it does like play into what I think of this as ultimately it's a story about bigotry, and it's a story about intergenerational trauma that's passed on, and also how we hide from it, how we cloak ourselves from it to cope. So we see in the movies, for example, they take this, and I have gotten through this part of the book with the gay bashing. You know, it is about different types of bigotry. I know from the trailers they are going to get more into the Native American community around this season. And I do wonder, since there was mention already of the Chinese restaurant, I was thinking, well, yeah, maybe next season they show the first Chinese immigrants to town, things like that, where it's just exploring how outsiders are not so warmly welcomed, even though it's supposed to be the North, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, we don't talk enough about how, you know, the North has plenty of racist people too, mm-hmm, and plenty of internal racism. It's just manifests differently, right? It's a little less open, but it's there. It's absolutely there. I mean, Chicago and redlining go hand in hand, right? So somebody needs to tell me about the turtle.
So I just want to point up, like, as Mark said, let's save the turtle deep dive for later. And I think also we should give the show a chance to explain it more. But just to point out how many times the turtle pops up, that there's like a turtle mascot at the school. And the other most notable thing is that, what's her face? The main girl, she gets a turtle charm from Maddie. And my question is she in a way protected? You know, she survives a few harrowing things, including where everyone dies except for her and Ronnie. Does the turtle charm protect her is a question lingering in the air. And we don't have to get into it now, but just so people are watching for turtles.
the turtle is a force for good, right? So that's what the turtle represents. And if they over explain the turtle, it will be really upsetting to me, kind of, because there's something, even through the entire Dark Tower, there's still a mystery to some of this stuff. But yeah, I think there is a protection element. The turtle, I'm trying to remember how much the turtle comes up in the films. It's kind of just
in the films,
nodded
not
to. Yeah.
At all.
Is there not even, there aren't even references to turtles in the background and stuff? Like,
I don't think so. One thing that I notice is, like, in the beginning of the book, when Georgie goes down in the basement, he sees something turtle like already on the shelf. And that is definitely not in either of the movies.
Yeah. It's turtle wax or something, right? And at that point, you have no idea what any of that would mean, because this hadn't been fleshed out at all in the 80s when he wrote this. Let's come back to the turtle more later. But like, yeah, I think, are they going to use the charm and things like turtle related as talismans? I will say, though, that the like outward school mascot being, or whatever, Bert the Turtle thing being so broadcast was interesting, because that's not subtle. That's like, oh, is this school a force for good? Like, that doesn't feel very Derry, Maine. Like, the school is having this, you know, it's not that everything in the world has to be the turtle. There are turtles in the world of Stephen King that are just creatures and stuff. But it is kind of weird if that's a very outward show of turtleness, I guess, which is a bizarre sentence to say.
Yeah, I'm curious. I'm turtle curious. You know, we'll figure it out as we go along. Why don't we wrap up this? We've been going a while, so let's wrap up this episode with the theater scene. Alicia, you want to read it?
The kids go to the library to research Maddie's disappearance, with Phil bringing his little sister Susie along. The search leads them to Ronnie, who is initially against getting involved after her father was investigated. However, when the kids mention Maddie's singing, Ronnie says she has heard singing from the sewers and joins the search. She takes them to the theater and plays a scene from The Music Man that Maddie was singing. The kids see Maddie on the screen and call to him. He responds by blaming them for his disappearance. The mutant baby then comes out of the screen and attacks the kids, killing everyone except Ronnie and Lily, who holds Susie's severed hand as she screams. Wah. So we're getting a new set of kids next week. I hope, I just don't want it to be like we kill off the set of kids every week, you know?
I don't think we will. I mean, I've seen the next time on. I think that they're setting up this. So I think they just faked this out, right? So you think that the opening scene is the Georgie,
right?
Is the inciting incident. It turns out that the whole group of friends dying is the Georgie, the inciting incident, right? And I think that was the fake out.
Mm-hmm. So
yeah. And we still have two characters, obviously.
Mm-hmm. I think those two characters are the Losers Club, right? I think that's what it is. We're following them, and that doesn't mean they won't die next episode. But interestingly, like, oftentimes the return of Pennywise, this sort of Pennywise comes back it comes back in a 27-year cycle, coincides with horrific human behavior also, right? So, like, you mentioned it, Alicia, that the 80s return of Pennywise, which is in the films, would be the 2010s return. There's a homophobic murder basically that takes place. And does that wake Pennywise up, or is Pennywise waking up the thing that causes such ugly behavior? This is a completely over the top, ridiculous, supernatural gore fest. Is there a human on human violence also thing that has either recently happened or is about to happen? And so that's an interesting thing. Like, if we think of, let's say we're towards the beginning of the Pennywise cycle right now, I worry that we're about to have that, and that this is just the kind of start of, you said the Georgie moment, but yeah, the start of what's going to be a really ugly couple years or whatever for Derry.
Yes.
Where are you all at with The Music Man?
I've never seen it at all. I've never been Music Man.
There's trouble in your Plex City. yeah, no, I, you know, that was one of the seminal musicals growing up. And of course, the Simpsons episode, you have to think about Monorail.
Monorail, yeah.
Monorail.
Never watched an episode of the Simpsons. So
wow.
So it's,
But it is, I mean, it is an interesting parallel to have with this because it is about a con man coming to town mm-hmm. and kind of turning people against each other for his own benefit so he can feed off of that in a capitalistic way.
Yeah, Trouble is, we talked about this musical in our episode, Never Mind the Music, about barbershop quartets we randomly were talking about last season. The song is sort of like a cautionary tale warning your kids about the evils of playing pool, but it's actually a hustle, right? He's actually conning them all. So it, like, I don't know if we're reading into that or if this is just sort of a nod to the era.
I'm sure they chose it for a reason. Hmm.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see. Trouble in River City, indeed, as they're getting ripped to shreds. I will say it wasn't Trouble clear to me who died at first. I had to like really think. I had to like think, wait, who just died? And it wasn't until the end that I realized, wait, kind of all of them or three of them did. I didn't know that at first because it's
even
such
the little
chaos.
Girl.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, you think, oh, she's safe. No. Well, no. I guess Georgie wasn't safe for the original one. So the small ones are not safe.
They taste like extra fear.
She was what's the younger sister that's super sassy in Stranger Things that tags along? I felt like that was an homage kind of to her. What's her name? Mm. And she gets killed just the same.
Yeah. I don't remember her name, but yeah, Mike's sister, right?
Yeah.
Is it? No, not Mike's sister. Lucas's little sister.
Oh, Lucas's. Oh, you're right.
Who's super smart alecky.
This is how little I remember about this.
Right. Well, it's coming back soon. Going to have to brush up. So
I don't think I need to.
So
I think
this is an example where this felt very Muschietti. It felt very like over the top CG, but I'm like, roll with it. Like it doesn't, this is completely within keeping of what I feel like the gore set pieces would be in especially the second film, you know?
But wait, are you saying that Erica is her name? Did she die? Do I not remember her dying?
Wait, who's Erica? Sorry.
No,
it's a little sister.
In Stranger Things, yeah. Mark is just alluding to it being the character itself.
Oh, okay.
There's a sassy little sister that's following them around. And, it's kind of like Stranger Things. And then she gets murdered like 20 minutes later.
Right.
That's kind of...
Gotcha.
They're setting up like a you're almost wondering, is there going to be a little kid sister in the Losers Club this time around? And then, nope.
Nope.
Because some of those kids are also evocative of, you know, there's... The tall guy, what is his name? Phil is kind of like got the Richie kind of jokester vibe, but also a little bit of Eddie Kasprak. Like they're almost setting up these archetypes that are king archetypes, and then they're dead. And so we're left with maybe just two kids, or maybe they have to get more.
Right.
I mean, the thing is, we are doing a prequel, and that means that Pennywise has to win, right? The kids cannot succeed in defeating Pennywise.
But he has to go to sleep.
It always looks like they win, but Pennywise always comes back. And I don't think Pennywise is gone at the end either after part two.
But Pennywise does either get defeated enough to be put back to hibernation or satiated enough to go back to hibernation. And we don't know which of those, which of like in the 1980s timeline in the films with the younger kids, we don't know like how much more Pennywise would have done had they not beaten him. Is it sort of moot, like they might as well have done nothing, or would there have been 20 more people murdered or whatever by Pennywise if they hadn't done what they did, right? But they obviously didn't kill him. So what happens here, similar thing. We don't know how far it would have... Like even when Mike is in his librarian interludes in the novel, when he's reading these previous atrocities in Derry's history... Did those atrocities end because Pennywise resulted in a bunch of murder and went back to sleep? Or did those atrocities end because a bunch of 11-year-olds beat him into the sewers? We have no recollection. We have no sort of information on any of that. And that's fascinating to dig into. Like, are these seasons all going to be tribes of kids fighting Pennywise, or will some of them, there won't be kids at all that are involved? Like, there's no reason that kids would necessarily fight Pennywise. They're just, you know, his victims, right? But maybe that's a common sort of universal experience is that there's a group of kids that will, that they're telling us, maybe band together and fight him back and be the reason he constantly is put back to sleep.
Right. Let's yeah, it's interesting. And we will see how deep they want to go in the show. I feel like the show, you know, I want to say my instinct is like, it won't be an interesting show if they don't have a Losers Club type of, you know, group fighting him off. But then right. I don't know. Like, are they just going to have like interesting dairy town politics? And I'm going to be like, oh, that's cool how it interacts with us. And maybe you do need a round where nobody helps to change it up a little bit.
Mm. I mean, because the only way to fight it off is in a group. They established that in the film lore.
Well, and that relates to the really gross ending scene in the book, right?
Right.
Is all. I mean, should we just say what that is so people aren't like, so people don't have to Google it?
Yeah. Look, all right. Go ahead, Mark.
It's just spoilers for the end of the book. No, it's like, I feel like a jerk, like referring to a thing. Like, this is not an in-group, out-group thing, people. This is just like a, I want to spare you. But basically, in order to like, friendship beats love beats Pennywise. Like, you have to have fellowship with your people in order to, and believe you can beat him to beat him. That's what happens in the film. One of the ways the kids in their 11-year-old selves in the book, in Stephen King's coke-addled brain, well, I guess we have to all have sex. And so they all have sex, and they're like literally 10 and 11 years old. And it's not super graphic, but it's graphic enough. And you're just like, even me as a 12-year-old is like, I do not need to read this. And it's, and they just do. And then they move on, and it's kind of treated like in their experience as this sweet thing. But it still is what it is, which is 11-year-olds having group sex, which is freaking weird and doesn't need to be there, but it's there. And so there are other ways that fellowship can be shown, I think, in the story. And I hope they choose at those other ways.
Yeah.
I mean, they deliberately omitted it from the movie, right? And I'm glad that they did. This is Stephen King, what the fuck is wrong with you? Can I just say that? Like, don't do that, guys. If you're writing a novel right now, avoid that kind of scene.
Agreed. Words to live by.
All right. Well, we did the episode. We traumatized the listeners with the original it scene. We'll be back next week. I'm going to do the outro alone, so I'm going to send everybody off here. But Mark, thank you for being with us on this episode. We're looking forward to hearing from you again in the season whenever you can pop in.
For sure.
Alicia and I, at least, will be back next week, and we'll see Mark's availability.
Great. Thanks.
Excellent. Can't wait. Yeah, looking forward to the early drop on episode 2.
Hey, everyone. I have sent Alicia and Mark back to its lair to await the next coming of Pennywise. But for now, we are going to do a quick outro. I want to remind everyone, Mark also hosts Nevermind the Music, one of our affiliate podcasts with his co-host, Nicole. They talk about music and psychology together. It is an amazing podcast, and you should definitely go check it out right now if you want to hear more from Mark. You can also check out Properly Howard Movie Review. They are just finished Bacon Wrap, their Kevin Bacon themed season. And that was a lot of fun. So go check out their feed if you want some good laughs with some good movies and some cheesy movies too. Check out Radioactive Ramblings that are just wrapping up Gen V, the boys spinoff. And you can also await their Fallout coverage, which is coming back in December. I think we just got a date. Alicia, of course, always has her Wool Shift Dust feed and her Star Wars Canon Timeline podcast feed. The Wool Shift Dust feed is currently doing a Frankenstein-themed Halloween exploration. So definitely go over there if you want more spooky goodness. You're on the Horror Hounds feed. You're on the It feed. What more could you want? And of course, you can wait for David to cover Pluribus starting soon. He's going to have a lot of fun with that one. That is the new Vince Gilligan show. That'll be on the main feed. You can find everything in the show notes in the link tree. So head on over there in the show notes if you want to go over there, or if you want to go to our Discord server, discuss it. Welcome to Dairy in siloed episode threads. You can also send us an email, of course, to horror@thelorehounds.com if you want to get in on the conversation, and we'll read your feedback next week. All right. My thank yous for the week. I have our Discord server boosters, Aaron K, Tiller the Thriller, Doove71, Athena A, Listu, Nancy M, Ghost of Partition, Radioactive Richard, and Adrian. Then our lore masters, Submartian, Michael G, Michelle E, Brian P, SC, Peter OH, Adam S, Nancy M, Doove71, Brian 8063, Frederick H, Sarah L, Gareth C, Matthew M, Sarah M, Andre B, Kwang Yu, Deadeye Jedi Bob, Nathan T, Sub-Zero, Aaron K, Dally V, Mothership 61, Gnarls, Kathy W, Listu, Jeffrey B, Elisa U, Neil F, Ben B, Scott F, Stephen N, Julia F, Kali S, Ilmariel, /Tim, Paul K, Rocky Zim, Jessica H, Red Zippy, The TCS, Catch It, and Adrian. Thanks everyone for all your support. I haven't done the outro in a while because Alicia's been doing them on the last few pods I've been on, and we already have some new members. So thank you again for your support, whether you're a lore master, a Discord server booster, anything, you know, just a listener. We love having you all around. This is what lets us go into these fun horror shows like It Welcome to Derry. We'll be back next week with another episode, and until then, enjoy Derry.
The Lorehounds podcast is produced and published by The Lorehounds. You can send questions and comments to lorehounds@thelorehounds.com. Get ad-free access to all Lorehounds podcasts on Patreon or Supercast, and connect with us on Blue Sky and join us on our Discord server. Links for everything are in the link tree in the show notes of this episode. Any opinions stated are ours personally and do not reflect the opinion of or belong to any employers or other entities. Thanks for listening.